Each one could have been the design for a Chinese wallpaper, and there are hundreds. There's incredible variety of materials: carved stone, painted wood, delicate porcelains, tile panels, endless expanses of mosaic, temple domes of gold leaf. Everything fascinates me, especially the rooftops. These buildings speak of great riches, of lifetimes of labor. Thailand is the most exotic, the most romantic country I've ever seen. There are two strangely discordant notes. Rising among the forest of temple roofs, a giant antenna, its huge saucers like ears to bring in the news of the world. I am told it was installed by communications to handle our trip. And then the lament of some Thai who was escorting me around temple grounds. He told me that when some pieces of the mosaic were damaged or lost, that alas, there was no more of that kind of labor anymore to do the repairs on them. Took too many hours, he said. I feel that if I were asked to describe Thailand, I would be like an ant trying to describe an elephant. I couldn't even see above the toenails. About 7, Lyndon rolled up in the big black limousine. I stepped in, and we motorcaded to the airport, along streets that were filled even so early with children waving flags. The night before, we had said to the king and his beautiful queen that we considered it a great imposition for them to get up before day to tell us goodbye, so they did not accompany us. There were brief, low-key farewells at the airport by the ever-smiling Kittikachorn. I felt like I was saying goodbye to fairyland. And then, at 8:20, it was wheels up, and we were headed for Malaysia. I tumbled into bed for a brief hour or two of rest. At 9:45, local time, and somewhere along the way, time ceased to have much relevance to me. We arrived at Kuala Lumpur, called familiarly KL by world travelers. I thought by this time I had seen everything in arrivals. I had not. As we walked off the plane, there was the usual red carpet. We were met by the king, Yang Dipuetan Agong, and his queen, and by Prime Minister Tunku Abdul Rahman, our old friend from a Washington visit. A very worldly, poised, charming man, himself the son of a sultan, who I'm told was a playboy until he was up in his 40s, and then set about really working for his country. What made this arrival ceremony so different was the blaring contrast of the old and the new. In front of us was a handsome new airport building of glass and steel. Eero Saarinen could have been proud of it. It looked like a dullish junior. Few cities of the United States could boast as much. But delicious contrast. We were escorted down the red carpet under gold silk umbrellas, tasseled, a symbol of royalty, and seated on a raised dais under an elegant canopy, the queen and I. I had been given a basket full of orchids, many colored sprays, by a little girl. There was the 21-gun salute, the two national anthems, flags everywhere. The flag of Malaysia is red and white, a crescent for Islam, cradling a 14-pointed star for the 14 states that make up Malaysia. The meeting with diplomatic corps and government officials, and then the speeches. Lyndon congratulated Malaysia for building a free and prospering countryside that can relieve the poverty and apathy upon which communism thrives. He spoke of Malaysia's own struggle against the communist guerrillas, which, he said, shows that military action can stop communist aggression, and also that peace as well as the war can be won. The 14-mile drive into the city with Mrs. Stephanie Bell, our ambassador's wife, was intensely interesting. It was a capsuled account of the history, economy, and ecology of Malaysia. On our left, there was a forest of rubber trees, so different from what I'd imagined. Tall, slim, white-trunked, mottled with gray, their foliage was very high. A few feet up, there was a chevron-like mark from which the rubber dripped into a cup at the bottom. The work of collecting from this cup was done mostly by Indians, Mrs. Bell told me. The ground was a carpet of ferns. It made a beautiful picture. We traveled on the best roads in Southeast Asia, she told me, and indeed they would compare well with any in this country. And there was a wide, high median strip and evidence of planting along the roads. And soon signs that said, Selamat Datang, President and Lady Johnson. And, alas, the largest billboards I had ever seen. Forerunner of what we may expect, I understand, if losing the fight to limit the number of billboards along the highway, they simply increase the size of those that are put up. I ask about the people that made up Malaysia. Mrs. Bell's answer, and later the Tungkus, was rather unsettling. Not a majority of Malays, between 45% and 50%, and about 35% Chinese, and it's from this sector that most of the trouble comes. 10% or more Indians, the rest a mixture. We pass an impressive university where about 2,000 students attend. The economy of the country depends principally on rubber, tin, and palm oil, and the nation's economic development program has been based greatly on agricultural research. For instance, they've produced a tree that will give 10 times more rubber than older trees, and then when its producing years are over, it lasts for about 25 years. Its trunk can be used to make paper. And the country is trying to ease its expanding population problem by hacking new land out of the jungles. For instance, Lyndon was taken to see a village of 200 families where 6 years ago there was nothing but jungle and a few communist guerrilla fighters. And I heard this strange story of their form of government. It appears that under the British, there were 9 sultans of 9 major states. And then 5 smaller states, I don't know the names of their rulers. The British left the sultans intact with all the trappings of grandeur and considerable power, but they had a governor general in each sultanate who lived in government house. When independence came some 14 or so years ago, a system was set up whereby the 9 sultans chose among themselves a king who would rule for 5 years and then be succeeded by whomever the sultans chose, a sort of revolving kingship. The first 2 kings had not lived out their term, but had died in the present palace, I was told, of undoubtedly natural causes. It seems to me a most unlikely system of government, but the Tunku is a strong figure, apparently a very well-loved man. He's called simply Tunku, which means prince, by everybody. Kuala Lumpur was a beautiful city, surrounded by heavily forested mountains, very verdant blue-green. Its public buildings an amazing contrast of the comfortable dignity of a British past, and the startlingly handsome new Parliament building, the National Mosque, and the museum. I came across such old friends as Crepe Myrtle and Canna, and cosmos-like small flowers, and lush tropical plants, the yellow flame tree, the creamy white frangipani, orchids everywhere, and hibiscus and bougainvillea. It was one of the most beautiful and exciting countries I had been to, and when I arrived at the guest house about 11, a big, comfortable white house of the Victorian era of British rule, I begrudged the rest of an hour that I took before going to the palace for our audience with the king and queen and lunch. The palace was a big, comfortable white house with many porches on a hill, reminiscent of the British, and all of their footsteps here, it seems to me, were good ones and remembered with more gratitude than bitterness. The king, a heavy-set, rather impassive man, escorted me upstairs. Queen was a beautiful, poised woman, quiet in her mid-30s, who became animated mostly when talking about playing badminton, which she enjoys daily. Upstairs there was a large reception room in which chairs were precisely ranged along 2 sides and the end. The king took Lyndon to the end and seated him on his right, with a couple of dignitaries flanking them, and I was close by, next to the queen on one of the sides. Some 20 or more other guests from their government and the American party filled the other chairs. And then an official, I suppose their chief protocol man, advanced in a very ceremonial way, extending to the king his gift to Lyndon. It was a very elaborate dagger. I felt a slight chill, and Lyndon quickly reached in and gave him a coin, telling him about the old story in our country. When friends make a gift of a knife, the giver must accept a coin in return, so the friendship won't be cut. And to me, the queen presented links of beautiful brocade. I had a ridiculous impulse to laugh as Jimmy Symington approached the king, decorously presenting our gift, and then backed away in a sort of a shuffle in order not to turn his back on him. Luncheon began with a clear soup, at the bottom of which lay 2 white round eggs, which glared up at me like baleful eyes. The Tunku explained they were quail's eggs. I daintily avoided them.
And
from then on, it was ours and theirs affair. Very considerately, they proffered us luscious-looking small steaks, green peas, cauliflower, and then a complete meal of their own exotic dishes. The main course was curried rice, yellow with little raisins in it, accompanied by a large platter of 9 delicacies, delicious chutney, little chips of salted fish, shredded carrots and other vegetables, and other things I couldn't name. And to cover the rice, a very hot, spicy meat dish that you might have found in Mexico. The tunku kept on warning me that it was hot, and I kept on insisting I was raised in a country where one ate hot things. Up to now, my digestion had held out wonderfully, and I had sampled in each country, with eager curiosity, the dishes of the land. It would be dull to go around the world eating post-toasties, and not a flicker of stomach trouble had I had. Dessert came, and I flashed a look Linden's way. It was tapioca, but not as we know it, in a gray-white little mold, quite firm. And then came 2 sauces, a white one that was milk of coconut, and a black one that looked like chocolate and tasted sweet, but completely unknown to me. And then there were fruits, which the tunku took pleasure in peeling for me and explaining what they were. One that looked like a large brown nut, and when he removed the thick husk, there were little orange-like segments, bland and sweet. And then another that looked for all the world like a large strawberry with thick hairs. And then my old friend around the world, bananas, but very small, the size of a man's finger. Linden had been enjoying himself with the queen, and I was delighted. Later he told me he had quite boldly asked her how she had met and married the king. And she had told him that she had been married when she was about 16, without ever having met him, a match made by her parents and his. He had been married before and had children her age. One of his daughters was her special companion. I envy him at the ability to get into such conversations, but I can think of no way to ask them such interesting questions as, can a man have several wives? Do they still have divorce by just saying 3 times you are divorced? What are the rights and economic situations of the women who do get divorced in such a manner? Later, I did ask Mrs. Bell. She told me the old Muslim order still persisted, but that there were some changes in the wind, an organization to demand more rights and status for women. After lunch, Linden went on to visit the rubber plantation. I yearned to do it all, but knew there was a limit. So I left for a little more than an hour's rest at the guest house where we were staying. And then Stephanie Bell and Topuan Norashikin, Puan is their word for Mrs., who is the wife of the Minister of Home Affairs, came to pick me up, and we went on a tour of Kuala Lumpur. First to the mosque, a beautiful building, a marriage of the past and the present. We were met at the door by the chairman, Tan Sri Abdul, and the chief imam and officials. We took off our shoes. We walked through colonnaded porticos into the prayer room and up to the high altar. I was enthralled by the artistry of the building. There was the lacy fretwork, the blue tiles that you associate with mosques of centuries ago, and yet it was as modern as tomorrow. You were never outside of the sound of running water. Delightful. A slender minaret against the sky is visible all over the city. The architect, a Malaysian, Encik Baharudin, accompanied us and explained the wall inscriptions. I signed the guest book, which I have done around the world. There was one moment when, below the surface, my mind was caught between laughter and amazement. Baharudin, my guide, said when we came to a round, high-domed chamber, or so I remember it, "This is the mausoleum for the great of our country. There is room for 7. This bold new country, only 14 years old, planning already a place of honor for its George Washingtons and Thomas Jeffersons when they die. But who will they be?" I wondered how the jockeying would take place for the occupancy. We went next to the National Museum. A little girl named Yasmin, the daughter of the director, gave me a basket of orchids on the steps. The museum was remarkable mostly to me for the enormous mosaic mural outside, a bold, colorful pageant of the history of Malaysia. Inside, there were displays of Chinese classical dancers, costumes through the ages, sedan chairs and beds, and model of a Chinese house, and most interesting of all, the Malayan shadow puppets. Actually, the building was more impressive than the contents. They told me that the old museum and nearly everything it contained had been destroyed during the war. Then our motorcade drove through the lovely lake gardens. I was impressed over and over with the lush green verdure of this city, the open spaces, the startlingly handsome buildings, of which the new Parliament building, rising like a white tower against the blue-green background of a mountain, is the outstanding jewel. It's as though some very good planners had made a well-thought-out decision to gain status, a place of prestige, in the world by having a number of splendid buildings in the capital city. They have, and it is splendid, and all well set in beautiful landscaping. In fact, the Parliament building has a huge parking lot so skillfully settled behind a rise of land that you do not see it as you approach the building, and even when you look down from it from the windows above, it is dotted with trees to relieve the expanse of cement. On our drive back, something a little creepy happened. I was so caught up in looking at the buildings and the scenery that I was forgetting my role, smiling and looking into the eyes of the people and greeting them. I asked the car to stop a moment while I could get a picture of the Parliament building. Suddenly, out of nowhere, the car was surrounded by a throng, mostly youngsters. I had rolled down the window to take the picture. The people surged forward, and we were enclosed, and Jerry reached back and rolled up the window. For one fluttering second, almost catching a thin, brown, claw-like hand that was reaching in. And Jerry said, in that voice that he used the night at the San Francisco Opera, "I think we'd better stay on schedule, if you don't mind, Mrs. Johnson. You were due back at the residence at about this time." I simply murmured, "All right." I was not pleased at my own performance. That hand was reached in only in welcome, and I was partly annoyed at myself that I hadn't calmly, quietly been looking from face to face and smiling into their eyes instead of hurrying away, and partly I was annoyed because I cannot stop to take a picture. I would like to have that freedom. Jerry didn't need to tell me that something was afoot. Later, I found out more specifically what it was. There had been some little demonstrations. Some 50 or so Chinese had raced up and down the street, tearing down American flags before we came. There had been a banner in front of the university, "Welcome, Murderer Johnson." There was a riot involving only a handful of people, but one had been shot by the police and killed. Back at the house, I wandered around the grounds, took my pictures. A lovely green hilltop it was, looking out at the minaret and the palms, the mountains and the Parliament building, but aware always of the little brown man with a rifle in the distance guarding the property. Inside, I had a facial and a manicure by a delightful woman with a title, Lady Joan Fenner, who told me stories of how her husband had helped with the resistance during the Japanese occupation, remained on after the British had left, and helped with the Malaysian government against the communist insurgency. She was the Elizabeth Arden representative and traveled around the world. I yearned to know how she got to be a lady, but unlike Lyndon, I couldn't ask. One interesting bit of information I picked up during the day from Stephanie Vale is that yellow is the color reserved for royalty, hence the yellow umbrellas, and therefore one shouldn't wear it. For dinner, I wore my flowered chiffon, and we went to the Parliament building itself, where the Tunku was our host, for a delightful banquet in which they had very graciously included 12 or so members of our party, always, of course, Secretary Rusk and Jimmy Symington. But I was glad to see Rostow and Clark and several of the girls there. As we arrived, 9 silver trumpets played ruffles and flourishes. We went upstairs to a beautiful large drawing room for the exchange of gifts. Tunku's wife proved as silent as he was vocal. In fact, I hardly felt that I had made contact with any of the women I met, except possibly the queen. The Tunku gave us a painting, a street scene of two women. Every step in this parliament building confirms the impression that it is a marvelous piece of architecture. Their quarters for entertaining are quite comparable to ours in the new State Department building. Downstairs in the banquet hall, I sat next to the Tunku for a dinner that began quite familiarly with clear chicken soup. And then there was something wrapped in banana leaves, a sort of Malaysian version of hot tamale, a paste or dough, some seasoned meat in the middle, and then roast duckling with orange stuffing, winding up with more exotic Malaysian fruits. Midway in the meal, the entertainment began, classical Malaysian dancers, and I highly recommend it as a civilized custom for 18-hour days. It shortens the evening and spices it, too. It was a sort of a montage of the history of Malaysia. One dance was definitely Indian. Another, reminiscent of Thailand. Another, pure Chinese, with figures inside a dragon. And another, Malaysian. Meanwhile, on the stage, two bands held forth. A loud, brassy, very Western Radio Malaysia Orchestra. And if there's any way in which we have made contact with Eastern countries, I think it is through jazz. And then there was an orchestra, purely Malaysian in instruments and music. The minute one stopped, the other took up. The Prime Minister toasted the President with a witty speech about the large bed, the difficulty they'd had in this country of small men in finding an 8-foot bed. And then Lyndon toasted the King in a more serious speech, the burden of which was that if China would increase its bread output, instead of atomic bombs, then she could be friends with the world. It was an interesting evening with a very articulate host. I found that these handsome buildings had been built by their public works department, that many of the architects were Malaysian, one Dutch, that they had some equally excellent low-housed causing. They had the highest per capita income of any country in Southeast Asia, something over $300 per year. And the mainstay of the economy is rubber and tin and palm oil. It seems a hazardous sort of government, and yet what it has to show for it after only 14 years of existence is substantial indeed. A very interesting, volatile country. I hope I shall come back someday.